Drew from Area 07 is our reader today, and Casey, 17, I knew that, is our timer today. So why don't we start with your reading here? Do you have it?
Short mics are an accessibility issue. Good morning, I love each and every one of you. My name is Drew, I'm an alcoholic. I'm DCM for District 33, Tuolumne County, heart of the mother lode. I serve as a DCM and I'm also finance chair for the California Northern Interior Area 07. That's right. My home group is the Sunday book study at Dave's Plumbing in Jamestown, California. You can find that listing at our website, aasonora.org. It's an honor and absolute privilege to share this stage with you, George, and the other venerable men and women of this panel. I'm also thrilled they didn't ask me to be the timer. Today's reading is from the General Service Manual. Trustees of the General Service Board, both non-alcoholic and alcoholic, have custodial oversight of AA's two operating corporations, AA Anonymous World Service Incorporated and Grapevine Incorporated. To guide its own sense of responsibility to the fellowship, the trustees of the General Service Board have adopted the following mission, vision, and action statement. Mission. Our mission is to serve the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Vision. We provide clear and effective leadership to the fellowship. We are directly responsible and responsive to the fellowship through the General Service Conference. We are concerned with all matters affecting the fellowship's primary purpose of carrying the message to the still suffering alcoholic. Action. In all of our deliberations and decisions, we shall be guided by and uphold the 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts. Thank you for letting me read. You can find that on page 50 of the service manual.
Aloha, I'm Casey, alcoholic, from Area 17. I hopefully will see you next year in Hawaii. For this session, each speaker will have 10 minutes. The green light comes on immediately after the presenter introduces themselves. The yellow caution light comes on after about 9 minutes. And the red light comes on and ends the presentation. If the red light comes on, we thank the speaker with a warm applause.
Thank you. Where did you write that down? Right there. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Okay, our first presenter will be a very soon past delegate in a month, and it's Tom H. from somewhere south.
I'm an alcoholic and my name's Tom. I have 3 years and 10 months of past trustee experience on your General Service Board, and it's in gratitude that I serve side by side with you. On May 3rd, I will rotate. I'm not counting the days. Let's see. What does the term group conscience mean to you? More importantly, what does it mean to Alcoholics Anonymous? I feel it is only fair to warn you that the title of my talk could have just as easily been, "Let's Talk About the Tyranny of the Minority." Nothing that I say today is in any way aimed at stifling debate or infringing on the right of the minority to be heard. I cannot think of nothing more futile than to try to tell another member of AA to sit down and shut up. Rather, I hope my remarks to remind you and myself that whether we find ourselves in the majority or the minority on any issue, we still share a common goal or aim. That goal is not to win the debate, as ego-satisfying as that may be. That common goal or aim that both the majority and the minority share is to preserve AA unity, so that we as a fellowship can more effectively carry the message to the still-suffering alcoholic. The essential ingredients to an informed group conscience are that all the relevant facts are presented for discussion, that everyone is given a full and fair hearing on the matter, and that we only act on serious matters when we reach substantial unanimity. Please notice, however, that the emphasis here is on the word informed. We can satisfy all these requirements, yet still do not guarantee that we have reached a right decision. Majorities, as well as minorities, can be wrong. It is possible to be fully informed and wrong. Bill W. recognized this in Warranty 4 states that all important decisions be reached by discussion, vote, and whenever possible by substantial unanimity. In discussing this warranty, Bill said, and when a decision taken in substantial unanimity does happen to go wrong, there can be no heated recriminations. Everybody will be able to say, well, we had a careful debate, we took the decision and it turned out to be a bad one. Better luck next time. Let me speak frankly here. Alcoholics Anonymous has had its fair share of magnificent malcontents on this score. People who apparently make it their life's work to produce heated recriminations that will fill your mailbox and pollute the ethers of your email. Unfortunately, all of us, too, often fall short of this ideal of civility that Bill held out to us. I think that Bill was pointing out here is that the extraordinary rights we grant to the minority and the deliberately slow process we use to reach a decision are designed not to guarantee that we will always be right, but that we will always seek to preserve AA unity. I believe that the minority's right to be heard is vital in preserving our unity as a fellowship, but like any right that we enjoy in a democratic society, it must be exercised responsibly. After all, in our society at large, we cherish the free right of speech, yet no one has the right to yell fire in a crowded theater. How then can the minority misuse this cherished set of rights that they enjoy? I think that all of us recognize that the informed group conscience should be trusted rather than anyone individual's or group of individuals' opinions, no matter how knowledgeable they are on a subject or how passionately they feel about it. However, I recognize in myself that it is precisely when I consider myself knowledgeable about a topic or when I am most passionate about an issue that I am least likely to be willing to accept a group conscience that is contrary to my position. It is at these times that I am in most danger of falling into the trap of believing that because the majority disagreed with me, they must be uninformed or misinformed. If they had just listened a little more closely to my arguments, if they had only progressed to the point where they understood my interpretation of AA principles to be the right one, then they would have come to their senses and agreed with me, as any right-thinking person must. Thinking in this way, I can continue to lobby for my way while giving lip service to the principle of working for AA unity through the informed group conscience process. In reality, I now find myself in the position of believing the group conscience is informed only if it agrees with me. Although I may have no conscious awareness of it, think of the spiritual arrogance I have attained. Essentially, I am saying, because you disagree with me, you are uninformed, and it is my duty to correct the error of your ways. By now, I feel perfectly justified in stepping outside of the group conscience process and engaging in any number of tactics to win on the issue, all for the good of AA, you understand. At the level of conference, since the process is flawed, and I certainly don't trust the committee system, I could directly lobby all of the delegates through a letter-writing campaign for my position. If that doesn't work, I imagine I could even circumvent the conference completely. I'm not quite sure how I would do this, but maybe a direct mail campaign aimed at intergroups would accomplish my objectives. However, I don't know if I wish to be seen as that extreme, so perhaps I should incite others and have them do that for me. I do not believe we can ever achieve a truly informed group conscience when the majority does not allow a full and fair hearing of the minority opinion, nor when the minority, having been fully and fairly heard on an issue and failing to convince the majority, refuses to accept that the group conscience has spoken and tries to win the argument by sowing discontent and exhausting the other side with constant demands to revisit matters already decided until, by a process of attrition, others give in. To me, we as a fellowship have to seek to avoid both this tyranny of the minority and this tyranny of the majority. I do not expect that there will ever be uniformity of opinion within the fellowship regarding the great many issues to come before us at the level of conference. These are certainly matters capable of debate. People with equal love and concern for our fellowship can find themselves on different sides of these issues. I am more than happy to engage in a dialogue with anyone on the facts of this or that issue and the application of AA principles to those sets of facts or situations. However, when there is a long history of time and effort devoted to seeking an informed group conscience on an issue, both at the level of the General Service Conference and throughout the fellowship, I usually find by this time I have long since ceased trying to win converts to my way of thinking. At this stage, my primary purpose in engaging in such a dialogue is to allow myself and others to answer this question. Has the minority opinion been given a full and fair hearing? Each of us must answer this question for him or herself. I trust that each of us in answering this question will then be able to act in a way that permits us to carry the message to the still suffering alcoholic and preserve AA's unity. I find myself increasingly tolerant of ambiguity in my life and in those around me. I actually feel more comfortable around people who appear capable of at least occasionally changing their minds. I find that more and more I bring a historical perspective to the dialogue. What can seem like such a life or death issue in the heat of debate cools considerably in the light of this historical perspective. For example, I like to remember that just a few years ago, I was listening to countless members of the fellowship announce in doomsday tones that we could not survive without the circle and triangle as a way of identifying conference-approved literature. Remember the predicted demise of AA that was going to result from the vans of treatment center patients and court slip bearers who were being dumped at the front doors of our home groups? How many other alcoholic Armageddons are but faded memories for you now? One by one, the informed group conscience has allowed us to weather these storms. I believe that when an informed group conscience has been reached on an issue, one can agree or disagree with the outcome. But if we are wrong, I believe a loving God will reveal that misstep to us in time. In the interim, our job, whether we are in the majority or the minority, is to work for AA unity. I pray always that I will never become so passionate about or ego invested in an issue that I am willing to tear this fellowship apart in proving that I am right. And finally, in those really tough times when you or I are absolutely convinced that we are right and everybody else is wrong, I pray that we be granted, with at least a modicum of grace, the ability to accept the informed group conscience, wrong though we think it may be, and the wisdom to wait patiently for an opportunity to say without rancor, better luck next time. What I've done here is to restate a presentation accepting the informed group conscience almost verbatim by the late John Skilton. John was a panel 47 delegate from the District of Columbia, a non-trustee director on AAWS, and a general service trustee. I wanted to honor his life and service to our fellowship, and his talk on this topic paralleled my thoughts, though John said it much better than I ever could.
Kathy. Good morning, everyone. My name's Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is Free at Last in Tucson, Arizona. So I hope you'll come visit sometime when you're there. And I hope you enjoyed the business meeting yesterday. Just kidding. Trying to bring some levity. It took me off the pedestal for you guys, so that was good. So I have a few things on my mind, you know, they have kind of been rolling around, you know, over the past year, and so I wanted to mention a few of these. The first one is, you know, we're at a service assembly. This is really a leadership, you know, growth assembly. You know, this is where a lot of our future leaders are and current leaders, and you know, and so I wanted to talk a little bit about leadership. You know, when GSRs, General Service Representatives, were first came about and elected, my understanding is that they were really so that we could elect a delegate. And so not to put more of a burden onto a GSR that's already, you know, working and going places and trying to, you know, carry the message between their group and the assemblies and districts, but you know, understanding what attributes and qualifications we need in the people that we're electing, as that is how we carry out our oversight, is really important. And you can find those throughout our service manual, throughout the concepts. You know, Bill talks a lot about, not just in Concept 9 and the leadership essay, but throughout the concepts, he gives us a pretty good idea of what attributes and qualifications are necessary. And, you know, and then in the front of the service manual, they're in there as well. And, you know, not only do the GSRs do that, but they also send, you know, 10 of our 21 trustees are elected on the conference floor, you know, by the conference. And so our GSRs are also electing our nominees that we're sending. So it's important to know too, like, what qualifications do we need in our future trustees? And so I can tell you, as a GSR, I had no idea, right? And barely knew as a delegate when I went to conference, when I was getting ready to vote on those things. So, you know, that's just been something that's on my mind. You know, and just kind of an example, when I went to the conference as a delegate when I was chairing a committee in 2015, I was amazed that out of the 9 delegates that were in the panel, 2 of them had not read the background information at all. And, you know, and we are volunteers, and so it happens at every level. But it just is an example of how important, you know, Bill talks about we can have a great structure, but leadership, you know, finding good leaders in the future will always be, you know, a matter of serious concern. Secondly, I wanted to talk a little bit about something I've noticed in the conference manuals. And, you know, this is just my opinion and my observation, and I could be wrong, you know, about it. So I want to say that. So it seems to me from reading some of the conference reports that sometimes we're asking our board of trustees to do things that we need to be doing. One of the examples of that for me recently was last year there was an additional committee consideration. An item went to the conference to produce a pamphlet for the unhoused alcoholic, and the conference, you know, the committee said no, you know, did not forward that as a recommendation to the conference. However, they made an additional committee consideration
asking the trustees to do the research to find out the best way to carry the message to the unhoused alcoholic. And to me, that is not something that our board should be doing, and really don't have the ability to do it. That's something that we need to do in the fellowship. So it's just something I've noticed. You know, I know for me, in throughout my life, throughout my career, throughout my AA service, you know, I always want to do everyone else's job. And I want other people to do mine. You know, it's like, let me tell you how to do your job, and while I'm ignoring mine. So I just have kind of noticed that, you know, with these extra get-togethers, these extra conferences that are being had throughout the year, I wonder if we are not quite understanding, you know, that ultimate authority is to be exercised in emergencies and when things go terribly wrong, not to micromanage each other, you know, and we all do it. I mean, how many times have we been given a job by our boss and then not the authority to do the job? Or we're even just a coffee maker on our group, but we're told how to make it, how much to make, what water to use, what coffee to use, how often to buy it, you know? I mean, we just do that. But I think, you know, authority and responsibility, for me, run throughout all our concepts and our service structure. And they're, it's really important for me in my recovery and my sobriety to make sure that I am allowing others the authority to carry out their responsibilities. So that's been kind of on my mind as well. You know, are we trying to do other people's job, the board's job, and then having the board do ours? You know, I just wonder about that. And I think really that's it. Even though I'm done very early, I just wanted to say that, you know, kind of what permeates all of this is trust, you know. And I was reading this morning in the service manual, you know, a quote by Bill, and I may not have it exact, but, you know, we trust God, we trust AA, and we trust each other. And I think it's really important for me to learn to do that in AA. So thank you. Thanks for letting me share.
Okay, David.
Good morning. I'm an alcoholic. My name is David. I worked out the math a little differently, and I came up with a little bit more in 10 minutes, so I hope I don't red light here. Maybe I can borrow some of Kathy's minutes. I served Area 6, California Northern Coastal, as a delegate in 2009-2010. I was the director on the AA World Services Board from 2013 to 2021. And for the last 4 years of that, I also served as a trustee on the General Service Board from 2017 to 2021. Now that is the only reason I'm up here. I performed a job that not many in the fellowship get to do, and I gained some unique experience as a result. I don't know more about sobriety than many of you in the room. In fact, many of you would probably say I'm not a good AA. But as Bill says in his essay on Tradition 3, we dared to say, quote, that we would neither punish nor deprive any AA of membership, that we must never compel anyone to pay anything, believe anything, or conform to anything, end quote. Thanks to the Alaska PRASA Committee for inviting me to speak anyway. My standard disclaimer, most of this is my opinion only. I hope you will listen. But please think about what I have to say, and please come to your own opinion. I've been part of General Service since 1998, 3 years after I got sober. I've said this before at previous PRASAs or forums. I feel like we've lost a lot of what I was taught when I was a newcomer to General Service. And in particular, I'm not sure we honor the group conscience anymore. So I may be mirroring a little bit of what Tom said. When I came in, one of the first things the long-timers taught me was to respect the group conscience. They said I could and should be as passionate about issues as I wanted to be, that it was important for everyone to hear what I thought about a specific issue. But when the group conscience had reached a decision, it was critical for me to accept that decision. If I disagreed with the decision, the first thing I should do was sit on my discontent. They said my perspective might change over time if I gave it space to do so. And after giving myself time and space, if I thought we had made a grave mistake that could affect AA as a whole, and that's a key phrase in my opinion, that there were proper and civil procedures that I could follow to see if the rest of AA might agree with me. And if not, then I had to fully accept the group conscience. One example comes to mind that may illustrate what I'm saying. At my first conference as a delegate in 2009, there was an agenda item to create literature for atheists and agnostics in AA. After their discussion and debate, the conference literature committee presented a recommendation to create a survey of the fellowship to determine whether there was an expressed need for such literature. Now, the background for that agenda item documented something like a 40-year history of that expressed need. Some delegates at the conference wrote a floor action, and one of them submitted it. It asked that we develop literature that focuses on spirituality and includes stories from atheists and agnostics who are successfully sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. That floor action was recommitted to committee because when it came up for discussion, it was 1 a.m. on Saturday morning when the conference should have ended at 6 p.m. on Friday night. The agenda item was then eventually approved by the conference in 2010. The following year, an agenda item was submitted to rescind that advisory action. Clearly, those who submitted that request had not sat on their discontent, even before seeing the result of the work by the trustees and subsequent conferences. They wanted to kill that literature. That request was not approved by the conference. What was eventually approved by the conference was the Many Paths to Spirituality pamphlet, which became the fastest selling pamphlet in AA history to that date. So, that indicates to me that there was a need and that the pamphlet, at least to some extent, met that need. And I believe that opened the door for us to several years later license the British General Service Structures pamphlet, The God Word. And maybe someday we will actually develop our own literature for atheists and agnostics. Right on. Now, it's not lost to me that by submitting a floor action, those delegates at the 2009 conference had not accepted the group conscience of the conference literature committee. That's not lost on me. I recognize that and I own it. And there are more recent examples, I'm sure, that we can all think of. Another aspect of this is those who privately and publicly complain about the group conscience, but don't choose to do anything about it. At a PRASA many years ago, a past delegate who was no longer in general service came to the mic and shared his opinion that the short form of Tradition 3 should be eliminated in favor of the long form, because the long form is more specific, that we include all who suffer from alcoholism, not just those who desire to stop drinking. I talked to him afterwards and I said, "You're a past delegate, you know how this works. If you want to see a change, you need to submit a proposal for an agenda item." And his response was, "Pfft." So clearly, he was one of those who just wanted to complain and not make any effort to suggest change. When I'm asked to speak about general service, I often say that general service is AA's mechanism for change. It allows us to change when we need to, and as importantly, it ensures that we don't change when we shouldn't. Now, those are only my words. You will not find them in any conference-approved literature. We've seen this recently in the reactions to our board's actions around the board chair. Lots of complaints, both private, public, lots of letters, motions for censure. But I am not aware of a single proposed agenda item that asked the board to develop a written and humane process to terminate a chair's term if that were needed in the future. For those looking for an apology from the board, I would mention Bill's words when we take our four-step inventory. Quote, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. The inventory was ours, not the other man's. End quote. We cannot expect amends from those who feel that we feel have harmed us. Now, I know many of you feel that the board does not need a code of conduct, that the tradition should be enough. Each group is autonomous, as is, in my opinion, each service entity, keeping in mind that they must remain responsible to those they serve. The board felt that such guidance would be helpful to them. I believe the board has the authority to create a conduct for itself if they choose to do so. I've spoken with current board members, and I know that the code of conduct has been revised to provide improved guidance if such a situation arises again. I asked whether a specific process had been created, and the answer was no, that it was unlikely that any process could foresee any of the possible scenarios, or rather all of the possible scenarios that might occur. So, my hope is that as a fellowship, rather than complaining or criticizing, that we take action, initiating change by utilizing the tools and processes put into place by Bill, Bob, and Bernard Smith decades ago. And I hope we always remember that love and tolerance of others is our code. If we forget this in any of our interactions in AA, then in my opinion, we have broken what we are. When I hear hate and loaded language directed toward others in our fellowship, it is so upsetting to me. It puts one of my core beliefs about AA at risk. I sincerely hope that in the future we use general service as a mechanism for change rather than a forum for punishment, and that love and tolerance of others always stays as the bedrock of everything we do. Thank you.
Okay, Paul.
Good morning, my name's Paul. I'm an alcoholic. Really appreciated being able to hear Tom and David this morning. When I was kind of new and young in Alcoholics Anonymous, actually, I wasn't young anymore. I thought I was, but I'd been around a while. And these young folks came up to me and they said, they were talking about taking me to a rave. And I'm sure you've heard about the raves these young people have. Evidently, they stay up all night, listen to music, drink, dance, and take drugs all night long. And they called this a rave. And I said, well, you know, we had something like that when I was in high school. We called it the weekend. So very often there's nothing new under the sun in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So when I was sober about a year and a half, I made a sign that said Denver Easy Does It and hitchhiked from San Diego to the International AA Convention in Denver, okay? While I was there, I bought this tacky little bolo tie saying AA International 1935 to 1975, and then I lost it for almost 50 years. And I found it a few weeks ago, and it was in a box in my room, of course, and I started wearing it because in Vancouver, it'll be the 50th anniversary of my first attendance at an international AA convention. And I merit applause by still being alive. So I was 21 years old when I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll turn 73 in Vancouver. And it just brings a tear to my eyes because I've been to so many. I've been at 8 or 9 of the internationals, right? So, okay, I'll stop now, temporarily. So, I also remember a time when I was early in AA, and I was sitting in the front row of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting next to my sponsor. I hope people heard that. New in AA, had a sponsor sitting in the front row with this guy gets up and he introduces himself as an alcoholic and an addict. This was in 1974. And my sponsor, who was kind of a crusty guy, but very loving, leaned over to me and said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't get any extra points for that. That cracked me up. Sometime later, when I was at my men's group, a guy comes in. This is a closed men's group. A guy comes in and he says, my name, let's call him John. My name's John and I'm an addict. Nobody batted an eye. The next week, he came to the meeting and he said, my name's John and I'm an addict and an alcoholic. Nobody batted an eye. The next week he came in and said, my name's John and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Nobody batted an eye. The week after that, he and I were walking into the meeting room together. I said, hey, John, did you figure out what you are yet? And, you know, we're joking with each other. It's a nice, nice man. And that night he got up and said, my name's John and I'm an alcoholic. It required some patience. It required some tolerance. It required some understanding. And it required the studied practice of old timers in that meeting about how to behave in situations like that. You don't yell at people and kick them out of meetings because they're not behaving properly. In 1946, Bill wrote a grapevine article that is now available in the pamphlet, AA Tradition, How It Developed. And the article was called who is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? And here on page 13, this is what Bill says. This is why we all judge the newcomer less and less. If alcohol is an uncontrollable problem to him, and he wishes to do something about it, that is enough for us. We care not whether his case is severe or light, whether his morals are good or bad, whether he has other complications or not. Our AA door stands wide open, and if he passes through it and commences to do anything at all about his problem, he is considered to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He signs nothing, agrees to nothing, promises nothing. We demand nothing. He joins us on his own say-so. Nowadays, in most groups, he doesn't even have to admit he is an alcoholic. I'm going to repeat that last line. Nowadays, in most groups, he doesn't even have to admit he is an alcoholic. He can join AA on the mere suspicion that he may be one, that he may already show the fatal symptoms of our malady. So, what do we see at AA meetings sometimes? Someone says, my name's John and I drink too much, or my name's Susie and I got a DUI or whatever. And somebody, well, are you an alcoholic? Well, how should I know? My wife just dropped me off. Et cetera. So, at one point, Bill wrote an article called, What Do We Do About the 600,000 Who Came and Left? People who don't want to put up with this nonsense about fill in the blank that is all too available at AA meetings, okay? I think we have, as a fellowship, as citizens, as friends, as recovered alcoholics, an obligation to reach out. I remember seeing old timers when I was new in AA who would seek out what I would call the weirdest person in the room. And often that was me. I don't know why you're laughing, you were too. Bill embraced all kinds. You remember that story from Pass It On, where Barry L. called Bill up and said, what do we do to this guy? He's black, he's wearing makeup, his hair is dyed blonde, he's a drug addict, he's homeless, he's an ex-convict, blah, 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 he's a drunk. And Bill said, well, run over that list again. So Barry ran over the list again. And Bill said, well, wait a minute, did you say he's a drunk? And Barry says, oh yeah, he's definitely a drunk. And Bill says, I think that's all we need to know. Okay. So I think that's true. As I read earlier, we don't care about their morals, whether they have a light. I mean, I care about their morals, but for purposes of AA membership. We don't care if they're a hard drinker or a light drinker, what kind of trouble they got in, their other complications or not. Oh, am I supposed to stop now? Oh, I got another minute. Okay, so I just wanted to share with you some of my thoughts about this continuous pressing issue in Alcoholics Anonymous, when we try to slice and dice and decide who's qualified to be a member, when all he wants is a cookie and a cup of coffee, a ride. right home and a little bit of love. Thank you.
Greg, you're up next.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Greg Muth. I'm alcoholic, and my home group is Steps to Freedom. I have one of those groups in Honolulu and one in Henderson, Nevada, where I'm currently hang my hat. And it's always good to be here with members of AA and those that are looking to maybe become members of AA. I sat up last night saying, now, Greg, get what you want to talk out and don't get hit that light. Do it early. That's what I'm planning to do today. So I've written some down. And I must say, when I came in the room this morning, there were the Ask a Basket was, well, the sharing was in order. And I listened to this gal, and she was giving my talk. I mean, word for word. But I'm going to let Bill repeat it a little bit. And first off, stats in AA don't mean a damn thing. Numbers in AA really don't mean anything, except the audited financial statements. Those are important. So my topic, and I've been at this dais before, and it's been... I still talk about the same thing, is AA growing. And I really want to plant that seed so everybody here goes and finds for themselves and think, are we doing a good job today of being attractive to that man or woman that may have a little drinking problem? Bill, on August 19th of 1940, he wrote to trustee Frank Amos. The great news here, of course, concerns the phenomenal and successful spread of AA. There must be well over 1,000 active members now. The most important happening is this. It has been shown beyond a doubt that AA will successfully blanket the country with no more than centralized assistance that can be rendered by the book, our central office, GSO to be, propaganda, and the relation of casually traveling members to beginners in new localities. Bill was so impressed with the unexpected spread of AA across the country that he penned this pronouncement in his letter to Mr. Amos. We have obviously contrived an approach so effective and inherently sound that it moves from person to person almost entirely upon its own momentum. Bill wrote in an article titled The Shape of Things to Come, published in the February 1961 issue of the AA Grapevine. AA's first quarter century is now history. Our next 25 years lie in prospect before us. How then can we make the most of this new grant of time? Perhaps our very first realization should be that we can stand still. Now that our basic principles seem established, that our functioning is fairly effective and widespread, it would be tempting, easy to settle down and merely one more useful agency on the world scene. We can conclude that AA is just to find the way it is. Yet how many of us, for example, would presume to declare, well, I'm sober and I'm happy, what more can I want or do? In the fine way I am, we know the price of such self-satisfaction is inevitable. It's an inevitable black slide. punctuated by, at some point, by very rude awakening. We have to grow or else deteriorate. For us, the status quo can only be for today, never for tomorrow. Change we must. We cannot stand still. A few years ago, the AAWS board held an afternoon sharing session to discuss, is there a genuine plateau of growth in AA membership? The discussion included a chart of membership, and we've always got to be wary when we're looking at membership numbers. It indicated that in 1939, AA accounted 100 members. And by 1999, 60 years later, AA recorded 1,250,000 members. Another chart depicted the number of new members per year. Although the numbers showed growth in membership, the numbers of new members had declined each year since 1990. For instance, new members in 1990 totaled approximately 68,000. Yet by 1996, we recorded an estimated 16,000 new members. The next 30 plus years, we continue to show those numbers declining drastically. When I sobered up in 1978 in Maui, the General Service Board indicated that over 65% of the known AA groups, US and Canada, were sending contributions to the General Service Board. The percentage of age of groups continued to fall. Several years ago, only 40% of the known groups, and again, a pause, 40%, we're not sure, but it's a number and it seems to be substantiated. So 40% of the known groups were participating. The December numbers last year indicated that at the end of 2024, group participation was now below 40%. And we see in the financials then, it's down to 31% of known groups participate with their dollars in the basket. The prudent reserve is now at 6 months. So my concern, I think it's when I look at myself and take my inventory, how many 12-step calls have I been on this month? I ask you the same question. How many 12-step calls have you been on in this last month? My phone used to ring off the hook constantly. My my third day sober on Maui in 1978, I was asked to join two members in a 12-step call. And we went off to this individual's home. I was the house cleaner while the two guys sat on the bed talking to this individual. It was the first time I ever heard men use words of love. I was just struck speechless as I listened to this 12-step in progress. When I got home that night, I sat and thanked God for my experience that day. And I then became aware that for the last 2+ hours, I hadn't thought about myself once. That's the benefit of being unconditional love and service to others. And I really love that Bill included some words in the 12 and 12 and the 11th step about St. Francis of Assisi. I have now renewed my effort over the years through deep meditation and a practice to learn how to forget self. Self-forgetting was the message, one of the deep messages that St. Francis left us several hundred years ago. And I think Bill knew that to be a successful member of AA, that needs to be the focus. It's not about me, it's how I can serve others. And I'm worried that participation in AA is at 31%. And participation on the financial statements is always indicated how many groups are participating with their numbers. And I'm amazed that it's down at that number. So I for myself, have decided to renew my efforts. I made it this far. That's great. and I would encourage, yes. No, that's dangerous, George. Thank you for your thoughts, though. But I think if AA is going to grow, I mean, do we want to grow? Do we want to be attractive? Do we want to do those things? Well, I would say what I do is I go, I serve on several committees that are trying to find, in Nevada we have over 1,000 groups and maybe, I should say, 1,000 meetings, and we have 300 AA groups. So times are changing, and I think AA needs to change if we're going to be relevant in the future. And I hope all of you will leave here today with pen and paper and do some inventory like I'm doing. How am I doing in carrying the message to the alcoholic or the problem drinker? What am I doing today? And it's always revealing for me, and I learned to write here. I never used to inventory myself. And I think AA needs a real inventory, that we ought to really focus on how successful we are. We have lots of numbers, lots of words, but are the new people coming into our groups? And are they staying because of the message that they find? I hope so. I hope we can change this thing, because we may not be relevant in the next 10 or 15 years unless we get busy and learn how to love unconditionally, stay out of judgment, and serve others. Thank you.
Okay, George.
My name's George, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, George.
I was talking to, I think, Rudy from Central California, and I said, mi nombre es Jorge. He said, Jorgito. Jorge, he saw alcoholico in my paso grupo. I'm Bracho. And I love our Hispanic members of AA, and it's one of the real pleasures that I have in coming to Brasa to see so many of my Hispanic friends from the Hispanic community. In 2 months, I'll be 98. In 25 months, I'll be, 25 months, I'll be 100. And so don't expect too much of me. I do want to say I love Arizona. I heart Arizona. I heart New York too, but I've been coming up here originally on business in the 60s when the pipeline was being built, and had some really fantastic experiences. And in terms of the AA, I have had nothing but fun every time I came up here to an AA event, because Alaskans are really good people. They make their own rules as they go along sometimes. but that's the way I am too, I think. You've heard some wonderful addresses, and I really like some of the things my associates up here said. I am not going to try and give that kind of an address. I just want to share from the gut and the heart to the best of my ability and be as honest with you. I have to be honest with you. Why? I have no motive to do anything else at this stage of my life, and having done I'm the oldest surviving anything. So I have no motive to do anything except be as honest with you as I can, and I'll try to do that. I love some of the comments. I'm fascinated by this pamphlet for the homeless. I was briefly homeless, and I was living in, what's the name of that park near the La Brea tar pits down off Wilshire Boulevard, and they have the dinosaur statues, because they had found dinosaurs in the tar pits. And that's not a good place to come off a drunk, because you're sitting there and the dinosaurs begin to come to life. And they're moving around, and you feel like they're coming at you. And you have to get out of the park very rapidly. For many years in New York, I fed the homeless on Monday nights. And we do a nice job. We have nice tables set up, and we serve them. They don't have to go through a line. And I kept that up until I reached the point where I wasn't sure I could safely get the plates of food from the across the room, and I had to give it up. But I would 12-step the homeless guys if I thought I saw a prospect. I'd give them a little card about 79th Street Workshop, where we have 60 meetings a week. And they showed up. And it's a, you know, a pamphlets are, they've served a great purpose. But I think if we go too far with this, such as a pamphlet for the homeless, which seems to me pretty far out, I don't know any. When I was homeless, I certainly wasn't interested in reading any pamphlets. But do we give the idea of we're taking, as one of us up here said, that's our individual responsibility to carry the message. But the more that we, GSO tries to do, and the board tries to do, and brags without quite enough humility, in my opinion, about all they are doing to carry the message, the groups and members getting lazy? That's not a, well, we send money to New York, they carry the message. And a drunk newcomer walks in from the treatment facility. That's wonderful, because the service structure has worked with the facility, and they send people to AA. And then we're nice to them if we like them. And if they're attractive. Attractive newcomers usually get a fair amount of attention, as opposed to plainer, less attractive newcomers. And it's our responsibility. GSO's responsibility is not to carry the message. It's to help us carry the message. And the more they do, and we in the service structure do, and brag about what we're doing, are we just allowing AA members to feel this is none of my business anymore. I don't do that. If a newcomer shows up, if I think they're interesting, I'll go over and talk to them. And I see too much of that and hear about too much of it. Another thing I would mention briefly is finances, because I've been talking to people here about what is going on. I'll just give a little history, and I was a part of this history. In 1976, that's 49 years ago, the Conference Finance Committee came up with a recommendation which made the trustees, some of the trustees, kind of nervous, but we got it through. And we had noticed that there was a stated prudent reserve, which was not very big. We had a prudent reserve limit of 500,000, but remember, this is almost 50 years ago, and it's so supposedly 300,000. But in examining the financial reports, I could see that there was all kinds of money laying around in the corners in the operating corporations in the Grapevine and AAWS. And so we suggested that the board redefine the idea of a prudent reserve, and that money in excess of operating funds in AAWS and Grapevine be sent up or down, however you want to call it, to the General Service Board, and that would be called the Reserve Fund. And I worked with them. We worked after the conference, and it was agreed that a prudent reserve would be between 9 and 12 months operating expenses. That number held. We stayed within that prudent range for decades, through my tenure, through Greg's, as far as I know, through Phyllis's. And it was a very stable figure. When I was hired as general manager in 1992, the reserve fund was slightly below 9 months, and the board was in a panic. They were really worried about the prudent reserve. Well, we got it back up, and it stayed within that range up until very recently. Now, I do not know what the board's policy, real policy, is with regard to what is a proper range for a prudent reserve. I don't know that they've really clearly stated what the prudent reserve is for. It's not to capitalize capital, to fund capital projects such as rebuilding office. AA doesn't really need much in the way of capital projects. It's for emergencies. And it's now, I'm not even sure what it is. I've heard other numbers apart from 6 months. And that's not prudent. That's a reserve fund. But my honest opinion, and I was president of a financial company, an insurance company, so I'm kind of used to numbers and financial thinking. That is not a prudent reserve. It's a reserve, but it's something that I think we should be concerned about, and the board should come forward with clear financial statements, clear explanations of what their actual policy is. So that's all the business I'm going to get into. I'm speaking. This Christmas, I received a card with a little letter from a former delegate from Arizona. She was a young gal then when I was general manager, and she referred to a talk that I made at an intergroup seminar in Baltimore in 1993. and she said she'd use some things I said in a talk that she gave on the traditions. And I remember the talk because at that time, relationships with theater group and GSO were not good. And I was trying to do something to repair the relationship, and I put a lot of thought into the talk. However, when I got this note from Linda B., the Del Past delegate, I couldn't remember what I said. So I asked her to send me a copy. I didn't know it had been transcribed, which I have, and I would be fun to read. But I made the point that, in a sense, there is no service part of AA. The triangle is recovery and service. Well, really, the service part is redundant because the 12th step tells us that we carry the message of the alcoholic who still suffers. Therefore, service is part of is part of recovery. It's a recovery process. And as I think further, to the extent that it's part of the steps and our recovery and our effort to work the steps, we have to conduct ourselves in service individually and collectively in accordance with the principles of the steps. In other words, we're no different in service. We still have the same obligation to live by the steps, and that means taking honest inventories, really looking at our own behavior, where we might have been wrong, where be careful of coming up with too many reasons why we made a mistake. If we decide we made a mistake, let's not come up with too many reasons for it, because reasons are excuses. And that's not a good 10 step, in my view. I call sponsees on that all the time. If you're going to take this 10 step, forget everybody else except yourself. Just look at yourself. And that's what I think we should do collectively. Just look at the mistakes we made. And I don't think that has been done. I've got a lot more I could talk about. But the final thought, I read the document, and my concluding words, which I can't read, although I've got it up here because my glasses aren't strong enough, are to the effect that my faith in AA, that I think at times we're come close to messing things up, and I worry that we, General Service, the board, and the office become such a powerful, large organization that there's too much concentration on the organization as opposed to the mission of the organization. We forget it. We forget why we're doing this. We're just so obsessed with ourselves rather than with what we're trying to accomplish. And I said that I had faith that even if we forgot these principles that we should be following and have followed, that have brought us to the point we're at the time, we need not worry because the principles are all there, and people will come along, we'll understand them, we'll get them, and we'll straighten it out. One thing proved it to me, I was so impressed when I was manager when the Iron Curtain fell and AA was organizing in all these countries, beginning and organizing all these countries in Eastern Europe, and I was at five of them, and they didn't have the literature that we had in their own language. They had no experience, but they caught on. They had what seemed to me at times to be a stronger sense of what the principles of service are than we do on our own general service structure here, or we're too obsessed with the structure itself. And it's no secret, I've been extremely concerned about developments in the last few years at the level of the board and general service. And I read these languages. Boy, I had a lot of faith then. I'm not so sure. Am I not so sure now? And then I talked to a sponsor of mine. He's a New York State Supreme Court judge, a very brilliant guy, way smarter than me. And I threw the question at him. He says, you know, I don't think we have to worry. If the whole service structure crashes and they close the office, it can be brought back. The principles are all there. What we have to do is try to understand them, not simply mouth them. And that's enough. Thank you very much.
So why don't we give them another round of applause? Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Let's thank the reader, Drew, and Casey from Area 79?
17.
Okay, sorry about that. So, okay. Why don't we close with the responsibility statement? Okay.